Hey, Berry besties. Welcome back to Life in the Berry Lane. I'm your host, Sasha Holder. Today, we're launching into my discussion with Jessica Setnick, a nationally recognized dietitian and educator whose work digs deep into something we all live with every single day, our relationship with food. Jessica brings an incredible blend of psychology, anthropology, and real-world compassion to understanding why we eat the way we do, how those early childhood messages stick, and what it actually means to heal your inner eater. In this first part, she walks us through where these patterns begin, how feeding and comfort get tangled together from the very start, and why so many of our current habits make perfect sense once we trace them back to the people and environments that shaped us. A quick reminder, this show is for education and peer support, not medical advice. Always talk to your own care team about your specific needs. Buckle up, settle in, let's ride. Welcome, Jessica. I'm so happy to have you.
Same.
Awesome. So you do eating disorder therapy.
I used to. I don't see clients one-on-one anymore. Yeah.
Okay. But you said that the tools for eating disorder care can be helpful for anyone. I'd love for you to share how you came to this work and why it applies even to those who don't identify as having an eating disorder.
Sure. So I stopped using the words eating disorders after a speaking coach told me that I should really take the words eating disorders out of my title because she listened to all my talks. And she said, everything you said applies to everyone who eats. And so at first, when she said, you need to stop talking about eating disorders, it felt like a stab to my identity. But then I realized she doesn't mean stop talking about it. She means take the wording out of the title, because most people don't identify with having an eating disorder, but we all have eating behaviors. So I started changing my language to dysfunctional eating behaviors or disruptive eating behaviors or problem eating behaviors. And that made a huge change, because once I was calling my talks things like food fairy tales, what's eating your clients, healing your inner eater, it appealed to many more people, and not in like a sleazy advertising way, more in a like, this is really what we're talking about way. And so that's how I sort of changed my focus. As far as how I got into this work in the first place, I was an anthropology major in college, and I didn't even really know what anthropology was. So if anyone else is in the same boat as me, it's really just the study of humans. Biology is part of it, culture is part of it, and the way that humans develop. And I was so intrigued by the idea of the way humans develop as a society, the way humans develop individually. And then when I took nutrition as an elective, I thought this was so fascinating. Like, what happens to food when it goes inside your body is amazing. But also, I felt like the choices we make about food, the regrets we feel after eating food, the way that food gets to us in the first place, basically the anthropology of eating, which is also one of my presentation titles. So the anthropology of eating, the psychology of eating, that was so fascinating to me. And when I went to graduate school for nutrition, what I realized was, even though I think those things about the psychology of eating and the choices we make and the ways we feel about eating and after eating and our experiences with eating, good and bad, the way that we talk about that should be in every area of nutrition. But at that time in 1994, it was really only talked about in the eating disorder field. And so that's the field that I gravitated towards, is the eating disorder field, not realizing that I had had an eating disorder. And because it wasn't bad enough, I didn't identify with having had an eating disorder, and that sort of informed my path once I heard that from the speaker coach, I thought, well, that's true. I didn't identify with having an eating disorder, even though I did. I want to bring my message to a broader audience.
Yes, and that is incredibly important. What does healing your inner eater mean in practical terms? And then why can that be powerful? Or how can it be powerful for bariatric patients?
Sure. So healing your inner eater is sort of a play on your inner child, right? And the idea is that your inner eater is the childhood you growing up, being very impressionable, learning about food and eating and your body from lots of outside sources. And so let me go back in time and say that when a child is being fed, an infant, a newborn, even though they don't have words for their experience, and even though they can't even see more than a couple feet away from them, they have feelings, right? They experience feelings, right? Anger, if their diaper's wet and uncomfortable, hunger, maybe even joy, cheer. We don't really know how an infant kind of expresses that or understands that, but they have feelings and they sense what's going on around them. So during the feeding process is a really important piece of development. And so think about if a baby is either being nursed or bottle fed, held in someone's arms, someone's looking at them saying, you're so cute, blah, 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 you know, that kind of experience, it links food and comfort together, right? It's very comforting to be nurtured, held, fed. If the person feeding an infant is either distracted, perhaps anxious, depressed, maybe mentally altered by drugs or alcohol, or not present, if a baby is just laid on the couch and a bottle's propped up with a pillow, the baby doesn't get those same feelings of comfort, and they may actually end up not eating, eating too much. It sort of overrules their internal sense because they are not getting the comfort while feeding. They only can get the comfort from the actual food. And self-esteem develops in these early, early days and weeks and months. When you have that someone smiling at you, making eye contact, that helps a baby, again, non-verbally, recognize I'm good. I make people happy. I have value, even though, again, none of those words are being used in an infant's mind. If those things are not there, then self-esteem is a challenge to develop. And an infant might even develop the idea of my needs are not being met, but because of the way we are reliant on other people when we're little for food and shelter and everything else, the developmental mindset is not, I'm mad that these people aren't there for me. It's I'm mad at myself for having needs. And so this stuff all starts very, very, very early. Then it can be reinforced in early childhood. And once we're verbal, we start to get verbal messages about food and eating and ourselves. Things like, you have to eat everything on your plate because I paid for it, or because there's children starving in blank country. There's so many things that we absorb from our outside world. And it's not just our own experience. It's our caregiver's experience. They pass on to us what they picked up as children and early eaters. And so the idea of healing your inner eater is to roll that back and to say, I wake up every morning thinking that I have conscious free choice of what I eat. And so if I make a mistake, it's my fault. When the truth is, there is so much unconscious stuff going on, so much that we have been layered onto. And healing your inner eater means going back and trying to spot some of that so that we can consciously choose if we want to keep it going or if we want to change direction.
That's really powerful. Is that how the influence map exercise works?
So when we met before, we talked about the Healing Your Inner Eater workbook, where there's one page that is a circle inside in the middle, and then there are spokes going out from the circle. And each of those spokes represents a person that influenced you when you were growing up. And it might be a caregiver. It might be a parent, a grandparent, a foster parent. It might be a teacher. It might be someone, a neighbor, someone who was around you during that experience of growing up that sent messages your way, either verbally or by their presence or by the way they spoke about themselves or by the way they treated you or treated others. That is the very first exercise in the Healing Your Inner Eater workbook, is to just recognize all the ways that other people influenced you and the way you think and talk and feel about food, eating, and your body. And then what we ask participants to do is to not just identify those people, but look at what their life was like. What were their experiences with eating? Did they grow up during the Depression? Did they grow up during the Dust Bowl? Was there an experience of food insecurity that they had, or some reason that they brought dysfunctional eating behaviors to the table, the literal table, when you were growing up? To start to see that these patterns are intergenerational. It isn't just, and I'm using finger quotes, mistakes that you make. These are lessons that you learned from other people because of the way they were raised, because of the way they grew up.
It's interesting how we pick up on behaviors and habits of other people. I know that when I was younger, I heard stories about women who, of course, when I was a kid, a lot of women were still stay-at-home moms. And so the way they cooked was a lot like the way their mother cooked and the way their mother cooked. And, you know, like if the grandmother didn't have a pan or a pot that was big enough, well, then she adapted to that and, you know, maybe didn't use the whole of something. Whereas, you know, the granddaughter has a pot big enough, but is still not using the whole of it and not understanding why. Mm-hmm. So that is really interesting. So when we do the influence map exercise, what is usually discovered?
Oh my gosh, it's different for everyone, but I love how in the workshop, many people, not everyone, feel very free usually to talk with the group that they're with, and even the larger group about what they've experienced. And just as one example, one participant in a workshop said that she realized that when it was Halloween, she was allowed to eat as much candy as she wanted, but the rest of the time she was always supposed to be on a diet. She was always restricted from candy. And now that she's an adult and she's been diagnosed with binge eating disorder, she binges on candy. And she never made that connection about Halloween until she really looked at this origin story. Another example is of a woman who said that she always has to have something cold on the table. And her kids make fun of her because if they're having pizza, she'll bring pickles to the table. And her kids say, but pizza is a whole meal, Mom. We don't also need pickles. And she doesn't know why she does it. And it's maybe benign, but she realized that her mom and her grandma always had something hot and something cold on the table. And that's how she feels comfortable. Another participant said that she always carries a beverage with her because her grandmother mostly raised her and always made her eat her meal, her and her siblings, before they could drink their milk. And so they always were thirsty and needed something to wash down their food, but they couldn't have it until they finished their food. So now that she's an adult, she carries around a beverage with her to remind her that she can have it anytime. So all kinds of things come out. And your question about how can it help people in the bariatric community, everyone's an eater. If you're an eater, then there's a history there. None of us grew up in a vacuum. And so it's very useful to look at eating behaviors. I think I love it. And granted, there may be people who, for whatever reason, don't remember a lot about their childhood or don't have anyone that they can ask. And that might be more challenging. But the fact that you don't remember is pretty significant, too. And so it's possible that there are things in your past that are sort of impacting you. Let's just say impacting you today. I don't want to say that they're all negative because they're not, but impacting you. I'm thinking of another example where a patient came in. This is not in a workshop, but she was very afraid to eat anything with carbs, complex carbs. And she would say, it's bad. It's bad. It's bad for me. And when we talked about her eating history, she remembered that when she was a kid, her family didn't have a lot of resources. She played on a soccer team, and her mom had bought two boxes of granola bars when it was her turn to bring the snack. And this patient remembers that they never had these yummy granola bars at their house. And so she ate a whole box of granola bars, and that was supposed to be the snack for the team. And she was severely punished for eating that box of granola bars. And so she really had to untangle that I'm not bad when I eat carbs. But she had, as a child, you know, you put together 2 and 2 and get 22, and it makes sense to you, right? You're trying to kind of create a sensible narrative about what's happening to you. And so she was carrying that into adulthood.
That's very interesting. Yes. I know that when we talked previously, I told you my bacon story. And
will you share it?
Yes. So I don't like bacon, which is disturbing for most people who hear that. But we discovered that probably the reason is when I was a small child, my parents were fighting in the living room and I was in my bedroom. It wasn't violent, but it was very, very loud. And I just remember feeling anxious and probably somewhat afraid because of how loud it was. And I knew that they were angry with each other. And so I went to the refrigerator, and I'm not sure how old I was. I think I was maybe like 3 or 4. And I looked in the refrigerator, and being so tiny, I couldn't really see too much above, but there was a package of bacon, and it was in, you know, like on a styrofoam tray with the plastic wrap. And I remember peeling back that plastic wrap and pulling out a piece of raw bacon and scurrying off to my bedroom and hiding next to my closet door, which I was kind of hidden by my chest of drawers, and eating that piece of bacon raw. And I scurried back and did it one more time, which is absolutely, as an adult, it's horrifying to think that I ate raw bacon. But I just don't care for bacon now. Just like the thought of it is gross. Mm-hmm. If like my husband loves bacon, so if he wants to have bacon, then I don't say we can't have bacon. I will eat it if that's what we have, but I really don't want it. And I never, ever miss it. I never think, boy, bacon sounds good.
Amazing. And to be an adult and put those things together can be really healing, even if you don't move forward eating bacon. In other words, you don't need to eat bacon. Like, you can have a happy, healthy life without bacon if that's not bothering you, which it sounds like it's not. But your inner eater can have a little bit of healing and say, wow, that was a really hard experience that you had, and you did the best you could to try to take care of yourself at the time. And so there's, you know, the adult you can sort of mentally hug the little you and say, you know, it's okay. You're safe. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you can still go forward and not eat bacon. So healing your inner eater isn't necessarily about eating every food. It's just about recognizing the connection.
Yes. Exactly. And it's really interesting. I've really loved getting to know your work. And so I'm curious, for listeners who are worried that changing food tradition betrays their family, how can they honor their loved ones while choosing differently?
Sure. That is so challenging, because we seem to think, in, I don't know if it's in our culture or it's in every culture, that if we do something differently, then somehow we are betraying the traditions, we're letting down our ancestors, that kind of thing. And the way I try to reframe it is that our ancestors went through the things they went through so that we could have choices. So, for example, my ancestors came across, my grandmother was pregnant when she got on a boat and came to the U.S. and couldn't actually get into the U.S., so went and lived in Cuba for a year and then was able to enter the U.S. So my aunt was born in Cuba. I mean, I'm thinking about being pregnant, getting on a boat in the first place sounds awful. Leaving your entire family sounds awful. I mean, the whole thing. And so I used to think, sometimes when it was really happy in my house and like I would hear chatter of kids and I would just, let's say, be loading the dishwasher. I can remember one specific incident. I'm loading the dishwasher and just thinking how lucky I am, how blessed I am, how much joy there is in my life, and starting to cry and feeling kind of guilty about it. And I realized that I was feeling guilty about what my grandmother went through for me to have this joyful life. And it took a real sort of attitude adjustment to realize this is why she got on a boat pregnant. This is why she spent a year in Cuba, was so that I could have it. She didn't even know me yet, but she was thinking of the future. She wasn't thinking of, I'm more comfortable if I stay where I live. She was thinking, I want the people who come after me to have a free, joyous life. And so it's honoring them, in fact, rather than betraying them for us to move forward. Now, you may have a different situation. It may be something like a religious tradition or cultural tradition. And sometimes that's something we want to honor in a way that is perhaps not food related. In other words, we can all gather together as a family and celebrate something without necessarily eating. But being Jewish, I do understand that feeling of, for example, when I encounter someone with an eating disorder, let's just give the example of latkes, our potato pancakes that a lot of Jewish families eat on Hanukkah. And the reason is simply because they're fried in oil, and oil is a symbol of Hanukkah. Well, if someone has an eating disorder, or even if they just have an aversion to oil or potatoes, they don't even have to have an eating disorder. If someone doesn't want to eat that, it can sometimes feel like you're getting the message of like, my great grandfather came here from Europe with a Hanukkah menorah in his pants, and it was his only possession, and you don't want to eat latkes. You know what I mean? It can be like you're letting down this whole family line. And we really have to try to reframe that. And it's hard in the moment. It's usually better before or after, you know, to say something like, listen, I'm not really into latkes, but I want to make sure you know I love Hanukkah. I love our tradition. I love being Jewish. I love you. I'm also not going to eat any latkes. And I just need that to be okay with you. Right? Because we do tie emotions and culture and religion and history to food, when food is really just molecules. It's really just molecules. We can keep some of the beauty without having to eat the food.
I like that. We can keep some of the beauty without having to eat the food. For me, that's powerful because, you know, growing up, food was so important for my dad. I remember, so my parents were divorced, and when we would go to his house on a Friday for the weekend, we would be eating dinner on Friday, and he would start talking about dinner on Sunday. We have tomorrow, the whole of tomorrow to go, and then like most of Sunday, we're talking about dinner on Sunday now. I don't know what I want for dinner.
Insecurity growing up, did he have issues with getting enough food?
You know, I'm not sure. And he's passed away now, but I know that my grandmother, she was poor. She became a single parent when my dad was about 2 years old. She was pregnant with her second child, and their father just up and left. And she struggled. So I can imagine there may have been some food insecurity.
Mm-hmm. And that is something that you don't necessarily ever get over. You can change the way you are wired, let's say, but you have to be conscious of it. And if he wasn't aware of what was happening, then he wouldn't have been able to change it. I'm thinking of my dad, who was born in 1928, so he grew up in the Depression. And when my brother or I wanted to get some ice cream, he had a store, and there was a Baskin-Robbins right around the corner. And we'd say, can I have a dollar for ice cream? This is back in the 80s. I guess ice cream only cost a dollar. Can I have a dollar for ice cream? And he would say, a dollar for ice cream? We had to borrow a nickel to go to the doctor. And it didn't make us not want ice cream. It made us kind of feel like a burden, you know, for just wanting something that a kid wanted. And I understand that was his experience. It would have been interesting maybe to hear about his experiences, but not in the context of you must be greedy or selfish or a burden, which is kind of the way that we interpreted it, even if that's not what he meant. He might have been, in theory, I don't know, because he's also not living and I can't ask him. He might have been overjoyed that he had a dollar in his pocket that he could give us for ice cream, but it didn't come across that way. It came across as, wow, you kids are really spoiled. And no kid likes to hear that.
Definitely not. You brought up another memory of, so I would ask my dad sometimes if I could have a dollar to go to the little store down the street with my friend. And he would say, I don't have a dollar. And I would say, but you have money right there on the table. Like, so he used to let me count his money and he'd say, yeah, but that's not very much. And so I don't know if he just didn't want me to have the dollar or if he felt insecure because of the way he grew up. And maybe if he gave me a dollar, he might need that dollar later or what. But I never could understand why he wouldn't just give me a dollar when he had a lot of dollars. I mean, you know, like, perspective is everything. So as a child, if there's $80 in the 80s, and we are talking the 80s, that's a ton of dollars. And like, why can't you give me one? But I don't know what his, you know, like what his responsibilities were.
And you know what's interesting is money and food can be really tied together in not a good way. Really tied together.
I'm thinking of,
okay, this is going to sound so random, but I promise you it kind of ties in. It used to be that when you get your car washed, there was like a little gift shop that you could browse while your car was being washed. And so I once picked up a book in the car wash bookstore or gift shop. It was called something about money, the Manage Your Money Workbook. And I was just a newly employed kind of first job, you know, in my 20s thinking, this will be great. I need a money workbook. It'll teach me how to budget or whatever you're supposed to do with your money. And so I took it home and I read the first page and it said, your money attitude is very complex and came from your childhood. So answer these questions. And it was things like, if you lost one of your shoes, what would happen? How would you get another shoe? Or what would happen when you told your parents? And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, my brother would lose things all the time. And it would be like the biggest fight. Like, we can't afford another jacket or whatever. What were you thinking? Blah, blah, blah. And I closed that book so fast and I was like, I do not want to go there. Goodbye. I mean, here I am thinking, I just want a book that teaches me how much to save, like what percent of your income to put in a savings account. And it's like, wait, revisit the horror of your childhood. And I think it's kind of the same thing with food, right? It's like saying, like, we want it to just be a choice that we make today. We don't want to go back and visit the things that made us feel bad. But it frees us in the end to be able to say, those things were in my past. They did affect me. And if I don't acknowledge them, they will continue to passively, accidentally, unconsciously keep influencing me. So my choice is to go in there, dig around, get support if it's painful, and then have a different way of looking at things in the future. And it's not easy. I don't want to make it sound like it is. I do think it's worth it. That's a choice everyone needs to make. But I want to sort of clarify that I don't think it's such a piece of cake, because think of my reaction to that money book and, oh, I don't want to go there. That was really upsetting. You know, I totally get that. But the key to me is, and this is so hard, but the more upsetting, the more emotion you have about something, probably the more good information is there.
Mm-hmm. I can totally see that, you know, having such an adverse reaction to something like that, there definitely is a high likelihood that there's something big that you can unearth if you just keep digging.
Yeah. And that's why I think therapy is good. And, you know, as an eating disorder dietitian, I'm pretty partial to eating disorder dietitians. It's good to have someone else's eyes on something, partially because they are far more neutral than we could ever be, right? And they can talk about something sort of that we are feeling ashamed of, and they can sometimes neutralize that. I feel like when people ask me every once in a while, people will say, how are you so comfortable being you? And I think what they're really asking me is, how are you sort of at peace, let's say, with you and your flaws and your quirks? And I really think it's because, you know, after 10 or 15 years of sitting with people telling me the things they were ashamed about with food and thinking, I'm not ashamed for them. I'm not embarrassed for them. I don't dislike them because of that. It occurred to me that maybe the things I'm ashamed of aren't so bad either. We all kind of make up stories about what's wrong with us based on the experience we've had and how others reacted to us. And gosh, I wish someone would have told me a lot sooner that the way people react to us is so much more about them. And I had a revelation since we're, you know, I feel really comfortable with you, and I can tell you things that, you know, are sort of random and you see how they tie together. I remember having this revelation. I was sitting on a plane and in front of me were two parents, and then on the other side of the aisle were two kids. So I could see the kids and I could hear the parents. And when we landed, the kids took off their seatbelts, and then the plane kind of lurched forward and the kids bonked into the tray, into the seat in front of them. And the dad lost his marbles and he started screaming at them. When we get off this plane, you will be severely punished, severely punished. I just remember his voice and his anger, severely punished. And it was this eye-opening moment to me that that dad was petrified that his kids were going to be hurt. And that's why he was screaming at them. It did not come across as the dad being scared for the kids. It came across as almost violent anger, almost the promise of violence. And the kids were crying. And I thought, this is on the parents. You chose to sit over there and put your kids over here. You could have split up and one kid sat with one parent and you could have managed their seatbelt. And this was your choice. And you're mad at yourself. And you are screaming at your kids. It was just so eye-opening. I was probably in my 20s or 30s. But it was this revelation of, oh my God. Parents yell at their kids when the parents are upset, when the parents are scared. I mean, it just, maybe it's so obvious to some people listening to this, but I'm telling you, that was new information for me.
Wow. I don't know about you, but I'm going to be thinking about healing your inner eater for a while and maybe side-eyeing a few of my own food stories. Jessica gave us such a powerful reframe today that so many of the things we think are personal failures with food actually started long before we were choosing anything for ourselves. In part two, we're going even deeper. Jessica and I dig into those intergenerational food rules and body beliefs. You know, the messages like clean your plate, treats mean love, and a lady doesn't eat that, and how they hit especially hard after bariatric surgery. We also talk about food as a mood-altering chemical, how grief and trauma can sneak into our eating, and what it looks like to start rewriting those old food fairy tales in real life. Be sure you're subscribed to Life in the Berry Lane so you can come along for the next ride. Hey, besties, quick disclaimer as we wrap up. I'm not a doctor, dietitian, therapist, or any kind of medical professional. I'm just sharing my personal bariatric journey and the experiences, opinions, and stories that come with it. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Nothing you hear on Life in the Berry Lane should ever be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, even when my guests are professionals. Your body, your health, and your journey are unique. So always talk with your surgeon, your doctor, or your qualified healthcare team before making any changes to your diet, medication, exercise plan, or anything related to your care. Thanks for riding along.